The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to the 2017 Internal Medicine Board Review Course, sponsored by the American College of Osteopathic Internists. The course was held March 22nd through 26th, 2017, at the JW Marriott Las Vegas Resort and Spa. The course featured nationally known speakers presenting a wide variety of topics of interest to the internist preparing for certification or recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Cancer in Women, Breast, Uterus, and Ovary is presented by Dr. Kevin Hubbard.
Last lecture, and then we're going to tie into board review questions. By the way, I realize you all have flights to catch. If you need to leave early, you're not going to offend me. In fact, I teach at a medical school. I have students leaving lectures all the time, so that's not a new problem for me. For breast cancer, for women, the most common occurring malignancy in the United States, over 240,000 cases per year. It is the second leading cause of cancer death in women. Again, as we mentioned earlier, lung cancer is number one. The median age of diagnosis is 55. Male to female ratio is 1 to 100. So women are 100 times more likely to get this, but men still do get it on occasion. One woman in eight will develop breast cancer in her lifetime. The risk factors are going to be older age, typically 55 and older, a family history of breast cancer, and that may also increase the risk for cancer at a younger age. Early menarche and late menopause are going to be considerations. A high-fat diet and then oral contraceptives and estrogen replacement are going to be a consideration. We also talk a little bit about cancer family syndrome, so remind ourselves of Li-Fraumeni, Cowden's disease, Muir syndrome, kind of an unusual disease. That's basal cell carcinoma and benign and malignant gastrointestinal tumors are going to be a consideration as well. You will, in all likelihood, encounter a couple of questions about BRCA. Breast cancer susceptibility genes. BRCA1 is an anti-oncogene that can be altered in 5 to 10% of women with breast cancer under the age of 40. BRCA2 has a similar role to BRCA1. When it's mutated, 85% of developing breast cancer, 10% lifetime risk of developing ovarian cancer. So you can kind of think about, if you're going to ask some board questions, how they might go about doing that. So a woman under the age of 40 presents with breast cancer, would you expect her BRCA1 to be positive? The answer would be yes. A woman with a history of breast cancer also presents with ovarian cancer 2 years later. Do you think she would be likely to have BRCA2? Yes. The third one would be, you have a male patient who presents with breast cancer. What sort of genetic abnormality would you anticipate? The answer there would be BRCA2. So hopefully this one slide will help you deal with maybe two or three different ways of asking those questions on the exam. Prognostic factors, HER2 is mutated in about 25%. It's a member of the type 1 growth factor receptor family. It's also a target for monoclonal antibody trastuzumab. I am leaving in the possibility of this conferring an adverse prognosis for about one more year. And the reason that I say that is because some of our later data that's been published just within the last year or two has suggested that because of trastuzumab therapy, women who have this actually do at least as well as women who have HER2 negativity. There's some indication that they may actually do better than women with HER2 negativity because of trastuzumab. So, you know, we'll kind of see how that works out at the American Society of Clinical Oncology meeting in June. I think it's too early for that to filter into the boards, but if you're sitting for the boards beyond this year, if you're going to take it next year or the year after that, this is something that I think you might want to just put a little asterisk by and go back and take a look at this again as you get a little bit closer to the examination, because I think it's going to probably change. As far as grade of the primary tumor is concerned, there's a variety of grading systems that we have at our disposal. They evaluate things like cellular aneuplasia, nuclear cytoplasmic ratio. What this basically does is describe the level of aggressiveness of the tumor specimen. Well, you know, how am I going to keep all that straight? Well, here's probably the easiest way to keep that straight. Tumors that have poorly differentiated features are going to be more aggressive and more resistant to our therapies than tumors that are well differentiated. differentiated. Tumors that are moderately well differentiated are going to be somewhere in the middle of the road. So if they ask you a question about that, hopefully that gives you a little bit of a sense about how to approach that. We've been doing breast conservation surgery in the United States for close to 50 years at this point. Lumpectomy involves removal of the breast mass with a surrounding mass of grossly normal tissue. It does require radiation therapy. So what do you do if they give you a patient who refuses radiation and just wants to have a lumpectomy? Well, unfortunately, if she's not willing to accept lumpectomy, she's going to need to consider a mastectomy in some form. If she's not willing to accept radiation therapy, she's going to need to consider some form of a better way to manage the chest wall, and the approach is going to be with the mastectomy in that particular setting. Hopefully she would be willing to maybe reconsider her options and look at some other things. What about sentinel lymph node mapping? Well, we do that almost routinely in breast cancer these days. We know that breast cancer is usually metastasized in contiguity to lymph nodes, and so the first draining node, known as the sentinel node, allows us, in terms of sampling, to really look to see if maybe cancer could be at that level. Now, the idea is that if that lymph node is not involved, maybe we don't have to go in and do more aggressive axillary lymph node dissections with their potential risk of developing lymphedema down the line. That's the concept here. Radiation therapy, again, valuable for breast conservation. Local radiation to the breast and axillary region is required in patients who receive a lumpectomy. Now, we are currently doing some things with local regional radiation therapy, and so places where we're putting intracavitary radiation and things like that in, those are really exciting things, and you may be at a facility that does those sorts of things. I think because it's not widespread, it tends to be more regional in nature, I don't see them bringing that to a board examination. So just so you know in advance. Radiation therapy is also valuable palliatively, as we've discussed, for painful bone metastases, spinal cord compression, brain metastases, and isolated pulmonary lesions. As far as cytotoxic chemotherapy goes, we really have a bevy of drugs that are available to treat breast cancer. It's probably got more therapies that are available for it than any other solid tumor that we treat. And you've got a listing of these here. In terms of trying to develop a little bit of a sense about what's appropriate, we've really got two or three different approaches. We've got anthracycline-based. These are going to be primarily doxorubicin or epirubicin as the backbone. We've got taxane-based. That's going to be docetaxel or paclitaxel as the backbone. And then we've got combinations where we're using both anthracyclines and taxanes in some combination together to approach this. We also have hormonal therapy, and women who are postmenopausal, two-thirds of them on average, are going to have estrogen or progesterone receptor sensitive breast cancer, whereas only about 10% of premenopausal women will have that. So now we've got an additional tool at our disposal. Agents for hormonal therapy, you know, still tamoxifen's at the top of the list. We've talked a little bit about it. There is a slight increase in the risk of endometrial cancer. It appears to be dose and time dependent. So if a woman gets started on tamoxifen, a month later she has some abnormal vaginal bleeding, no, she did not develop endometrial cancer. If she's been on tamoxifen 2 or 3 years, though, I think my concern would start to go up, that possibly this is a tamoxifen-related process. Anastrozole, also known as Arimidex, is an aromatase inhibitor that decreases conversions of androgens to estrogens, which we talked about a little bit earlier. It appears slightly more effective than tamoxifen in an adjuvant setting, but I think this is just kind of a marginal step forward. It is not a panacea compared to tamoxifen. There is an increased risk of osteoporosis with this, and oftentimes patients will complain of arthralgias and myalgias, and so certainly a concern. Other agents that we've got, letrozole and exemestane, these are also aromatase inhibitors. For letrozole, it's approved for adjuvant use as well as switching strategies that we might use. A woman says, you know, I don't want to be on tamoxifen anymore. I don't like the hot flashes. I don't like the way it makes me feel. Great. Well, let's consider switching to anastrozole or letrozole. Would certainly be a very appropriate way to do that. Exemestane is a steroidal aromatase inhibitor. The other two are non-steroidal in nature. We know that we got some switching strategies as well here. We might consider utilizing it for an additional an additional 2 to 3 years after tamoxifen. We're still kind of trying to figure out, though, about how long people ought to be on these therapies. And so more recent data suggested with tamoxifen, maybe we ought to be treating these patients for 10 years. The Atlas and Adam trials that were reported within the last couple of years demonstrated that it prevents up to half of the cancers after 10 years of therapy. And so it leads you to suspicion that a longer course of therapy would be appropriate. So I think currently it's fair to say that you can utilize tamoxifen for 10 years in women who are likely to benefit most, and those would be women under the age of 70, women who have a life expectancy of 15 years or more. Now, there's no data yet on aromatase inhibitors longer than 5 years. You will probably hear something about that this summer, though. So when you go home, you kind of get into the thick of things. This may be a big news flash, because I think we're going to probably hear that there's data for aromatase inhibitors up to 10 years. But for the examination, we don't have that yet. So that's the take-home message. As far as general principles for breast cancer are concerned, heterogeneous disease, more than one approach is reasonable. If it's non-metastatic, we're going for cure. If it is metastatic, we're going for palliation and quality of life. So they might give you a patient who has a small primary, has negative lymph nodes. Here you think about breast conservation therapy and radiation therapy. Adjuvant systemic therapy would be a consideration if the tumor is a centimeter or larger in size, or in patients who have multiple adverse prognostic factors. And so HER2 positivity, or they've got evidence of poor differentiation, some of those things, that would be a consideration. They might give you a patient with lymph node positive breast cancer. Well, in that situation, you kind of want to get a sense about what the primary lesion would be. If it's more than 4 centimeters in size, mastectomy might be a reasonable approach. We have seen patients benefit from preoperative chemotherapy if they're acceptable candidates. You sort of downsize the tumor. Some of those patients may undergo breast conservation at that point. They all get some sort of adjuvant systemic therapy at that point. This is always a train wreck. This is a heartbreaker. You know, this is a type of thing that you really hate seeing. This is inflammatory carcinoma, also known as locally advanced breast cancer. In these patients, multimodality therapy is the key. And we're going to start off in many of these cases, because we're trying to get a quick reduction in the amount of tumor and to get hold on this, with chemotherapy. And then we will consider surgery and radiation therapy after we've had a course of therapy. And then additional systemic therapies as indicated. Most of these patients are incurable, but the goal is to try to create a situation where we now have control of the tumor, we can improve quality of life, and our goal is that maybe they'll do well for a couple of years in this setting. 5-year survival rate in patients with locally advanced breast cancer, unfortunately, is less than 20%. Metastatic breast cancer management considerations, surgical treatment of the breast is really not required, but there can be some psychological benefit from mastectomy. Women will often complain that the breast feels heavy, it feels nodular. This is admittedly a rather unique cancer, because you can't really go around and palpate your colon cancer or your lung cancer. But if you're a woman and you've got breast cancer, it's right here. It's ever present, and you have to deal with it all the time. So the use of mastectomy in this situation may provide some women the option of getting some psychological support and just helping improve how they feel about things. These patients are treated primarily for palliative intent. The disease course can be extremely variable. So just because we're in a situation where we've got this prognosis and it doesn't look the best, every oncologist out there who's been doing this for a while will tell you about patients with metastatic disease that we've had in our practice for anywhere from 2 years to as long as 10 or 12 years, and they continue to have very full and productive lives. Their overall quality of their life, as they rate it, is very high. So just because we have a patient who has advanced disease, this is one of those diseases where I think we can make an impact in a substantial portion of our patients. Let's talk a little bit about those in situ carcinomas. These do tend to show up on boards as well. If you're doing primary care, if you're doing ambulatory internal medicine, you're probably going to have a few patients a year who have this. So for ductal carcinoma in situ, we've really seen an increase in diagnosis with mammography. These typically get worked up for microcalcifications or soft tissue abnormality on exam. We've got some histologic features to consider, comedocarcinomas versus non-comedocarcinomas. And as you can see, we got about three or four little subtypes pathologically. But it all kind of comes down to ductal carcinoma in situ for ease of the board exam. The treatment for these can be lumpectomy plus radiation. Post-lumpectomy and radiation, tamoxifen has been demonstrated to reduce the risk of breast cancer recurrence in both breasts, the ipsilateral breast and the contralateral breast. In those patients who were not interested in really pursuing lumpectomy, you might consider a simple mastectomy. They do not need to have their lymph node sampled. This is a pre-invasive process. Sometimes you'll get cases back where there's extensive ductal carcinoma in situ. If you see something on a board exam that says extensive DCIS, those patients are really best served by simple mastectomy. Simple lumpectomy, radiation, really is not going to give you the type of long-term control that we would like to have. Lobular carcinoma in situ is kind of an oddball. It's in many cases, it's not even considered cancer, although, you know, it does say CIS. So, you know, there is a history of carcinoma, I think. We work that into the name. It's also known as lobular neoplasia or atypical lobular hyperplasia. It's usually multicentric. It's oftentimes bilateral. In fact, back when I was growing up in medical school, we heard about them doing mirror biopsies to pick up these sorts of things because of that. There's a 21% chance of developing breast cancer in 15 years. So certainly think of this as a precursor lesion. These patients can be managed by close follow-up with annual breast examination every 4 to 12 months. It is appropriate to take out the nodule that's causing the concern. That helps make the diagnosis. Annual mammography, at least, is considered appropriate. Tamoxifen can be used for prevention of breast cancer as well. In those patients who are having recurrent problems with this, or in those patients who say, you know, I really don't like having something that could cause cancer on my body, I would like to pursue this, bilateral prophylactic mastectomy is a consideration for some of those patients. Breast reconstruction, just offer a plug. There's a lot of good things that can happen with breast reconstruction, and here you can see responses can be very good. It obviously does not look like the original breast look, but in surveys where we've asked patients about how they feel about this, we get survey satisfaction rates of as high as 85% in women reporting excellent or very good satisfaction with the results that they've gotten. Some women would prefer not to have surgery, and a breast prosthesis is certainly an appropriate thing to do. Think a little bit about breast cancer prevention. I'm going to try to keep this brief because I do know we've got a couple more things to cover. Tamoxifen and raloxifene have proven equally effective in lowering the risk of a second primary. Again, remember, raloxifene in the NSABP P2 trial did not reduce the risk of in situ carcinomas, and so something to keep in mind. We're going to turn next to endometrial carcinoma. It's the most common gynecologic cancer that we have to deal with. 75% of these are going to occur after the age of 50, only 4% prior to age 40. It's hereditary in some family. Its rate is increased in industrialized society. So sometimes you'll see them play in these games with gynecologic cancers. Risk is increased with, risk is decreased with. This is kind of the one area in medicine where you tend to see that. So I want to make sure we get that in front of you. So the risk of endometrial carcinoma is increased with obesity, hyperinsulinemia, unopposed estrogenic stimulation. It causes adenomatous hyperplasia, so use progesterone. Again, lowest effective dose of estrogen and a progestational agent. Those patients who have anovulation, so Stein-Leventhal and premature ovarian failure, also think about family cancer syndromes as we've discussed previously. Atypical adenomatous hyperplasia, the risk is 10 to 30% at 10 years if it's untreated. What about tamoxifen? Risk of endometrial carcinoma is slightly increased. The relative risk increase is like 1.2. So it's not a huge increase, but there definitely is an increase. And so yearly gynecologic exams in women that are taking tamoxifen, and you want to investigate vaginal bleeding in any woman who's taking tamoxifen. Again, this is dose and time dependent. That first first year, you're probably going to be okay. Beyond that, the risk is going to gradually increase for the duration of therapy. So now that we're thinking about tamoxifen for 10 years in women who still have a uterus, I think that's something that we really need to pay a little bit more attention to, because they're going to be on for quite a while. Adenocarcinoma, 90% of these. Other types, clear cell, small cell, sarcomas. If you get a sarcoma, leiomyosarcoma is going to be the most frequent. Vaginal spotting or bleeding, and particularly postmenopausal vaginal spotting or bleeding, are going to be the primary concerns here. You want to investigate that in a postmenopausal woman. If you look at all comers in an unselected patient population other than their postmenopausal, the risk of malignancy is as high as 35% in some series. With advanced disease, pelvic fullness and pain, constitutional symptoms and ascites are going to be a part of that, so got to be on the lookout. Aspiration curettage is most often employed, but it can't detect precursor lesions, and that's part of the challenge that we have, is we don't have a good way to detect these things early. D&C is accurate in about 90% of cases, but there's currently no good technique to screen women in general or those at risk. The FIGO classification as far as staging falls in pretty good here, and we're not going to get really lost into the weeds, but I'll kind of talk you through some key points in the next three or four slides that I think will kind of help you see in some things that you can take with you on the boards. Laboratory studies, again, chest x-ray, liver renal function, radiologic studies, again, as we've outlined, CT scanning would be helpful. And so to move on for treatment of stage one disease, total abdominal hysterectomy, bilateral salpingo-oophorectomy, pelvic lymphadenectomy, if it involves the outer half of the myometrium. If you have patients who have disease of the outer half of the myometrium, that's technically 1C disease. Those patients have an increased risk for metastases, and so they're going to get treated appropriately. If they go to surgery and lymph nodes are positive, that actually is stage 3 disease in that situation, and those patients are going to be treated accordingly. Also, any case where you have grade 3 histology, grade 1, grade 2 are considered pretty good actors. Grade 3 histology would be the bad actor here. For stage 2 disease, we've got to include the parametria, the vagina, and the pelvic lymph nodes. Here we're thinking surgery and radiation therapy. In that situation, radiation therapy is going to be brachytherapy followed by pelvic radiation. For stage 3 disease, now we have disease that's more advanced, and these patients are going to be at risk of lymph node involvement. They could have involvement of other contiguous structures. And so we're thinking in this situation, total abdominal hysterectomy with periaortic lymphadenectomy and omentectomy. We will then treat those patients with adjuvant chemotherapy, following which we'll treat them with radiation therapy. As you can tell, platinum doublets are really the background here, cisplatin or carboplatin, and docetaxel or paclitaxel. If it helps, this is the same type of regimen that we would use in treating ovarian carcinomas. And so, you know, fortunately, with these gynecologic malignancies, this is the only regimen that you really need to be all that aware of. For stage 4 disease, now it's spread to the omentum, it's spread to distant sites, could be spread up as far as the liver. Treatment here is mostly palliative. Our chemotherapy is given cautiously for control of symptoms. Hormonal therapy has been tried. Some of our later studies have shown that there might be a modest amount of efficacy, but I think more than anything else, probably fewer side effects than cytotoxic chemotherapy. Surgery has a limited role. We'll try to avoid obstruction of hollow viscera in that particular setting. Okay, so we'll talk lastly about ovarian carcinoma. It arises from epithelial tissue 75% of the time. You do find occasional germ cell tumors arising here. And interestingly enough, that accounts for 65% of all ovarian malignancies in women under the age of 20. So if you see an ovarian mass in a young woman, late teens, early 20s, it's probably not going to be epithelial ovarian cancer. It's probably going to be a germ cell. 22,000 cases, 14,000 deaths per year, more common in westernized cultures. Median age at onset is about 48. 50% of cases currently occur in women over the age of 65. What decreases the risk of developing ovarian cancer? Well, pregnancy under the age of 25, early menopause under the age of 50, and oral contraceptives. Those things tend to decrease the risk. What increases the risk? Late menopause, nulliparity, age over 30 at first pregnancy, Family history. Now, remember, kind of think about BRCA1, BRCA2, how they play in here. Think about other family cancer syndromes. Think about the linkage of breast, endometrial, and colorectal carcinomas with ovarian carcinoma as well. So you kind of get a sense, coming back to this, about how this might all work together. There are several varieties pathologically, and probably the ovary is one of the more pathologically diverse areas of the body to have to think about. So we've got epithelial tumors, we've got sex cord and stromal tumors, and germ cell tumors. We're only going to be spending time talking about epithelial ovarian tumors because that's 90% of the total. So you have treatment of borderline tumors. Typically, if you're treating borderline tumors, they have low metastatic potential. Removal of the involved ovary should be sufficient in 95% of cases. Reoperation with subsequent chemotherapy if disease recurs. Now, I will tell you one thing that you need to know about. The only time you will see a metastatic borderline ovarian tumor is on boards. But it has been known to happen. I have no idea why they put that on there. But if you get a metastatic borderline ovarian tumor, you treat it with chemotherapy. And traditionally, it's going to be with the same type of chemotherapy that you would use to treat epithelial ovarian carcinoma. It's going to be a platinum doublet, platinum plus a taxane. So just so you know in advance. But invariably, almost every year, I hear somebody telling me, yeah, they had a metastatic borderline ovarian tumor. That's how you treat it. So fortunately, hopefully you'll nail that question and you'll get it taken care of. Again, we're not going to talk about the stromal ovarian tumors other than to say surgery is the primary treatment. Chemotherapy and radiation are used in advanced cases. Germ cell tumors, we treat them with the same general principles that we treat germ cell tumors in males. They need to have surgery for initial diagnosis and they get chemotherapy and they tend to do quite well. So for surgery for ovarian carcinomas, this involves a detailed surgery with washings of the peritoneum, multiple biopsies, resection of as much tumor as possible. And we refer to that generally as cytoreductive surgery. We'll talk a little bit more about that momentarily. We're also going to do some radiographic studies, imaging studies. In some cases, we like to get an IVP, or at the very least, they'll do IV contrast, trying to outline the ureters. The surgeons kind of like to know where those things are ahead of time. We'll also go ahead and do chemistries, biochemical profile. I do not generally check a CA-125 in these patients at the outset. I may check it prior to initiation of treatment for patients who have a little bit more advanced disease, because now I can follow that marker as a surrogate for how well patients are responding. So again, we're going to talk about ovarian epithelial carcinoma. Surgery is the primary treatment for all stages and types. So what they need to have is a removal of as much tumor as possible in the case of metastases. Sometimes you'll get a question and it's, you know, they take the patient to surgery and it's sort of a peek and shriek. They'll get a biopsy and oh my goodness, it's everywhere. There's nothing we can do. So they'll close the patient back up and it comes back epithelial ovarian carcinoma. What's the right answer? Well, the right answer is twofold. One, back historically, you tend to send the patient back to surgery, have them do a cytoreductive surgery, have them do the surgery that they need to get help. The other thing more recently is that we've been giving chemotherapy up front in that case to try to provide initial cytoreduction with the plan to go back and do a cytoreductive surgery a little bit later in the course of their treatment. So one way or the other, we're going to head them back to the OR. So that's the important point. Why would we do that? Well, the reason is that patients who can be debulked such that their total tumor mass is less than 2 centimeters in maximum dimension, they're going to have survival times 2 to 4 times that of patients who have residual tumor masses that are greater than 2 centimeters. We do it because it improves survival, and because of the debilitating effects that intraperitoneal malignancies can cause, we're going to improve quality of life in these patients. So that's why we do it. We do have a fair variety of chemotherapeutic agents that are here. Combinations, again, are more active than single agents. We've talked a little bit about regimens that are effective. Chemotherapy is the mainstay of treatment for metastatic ovarian carcinoma, and it's also a value for adjuvant therapy for disease beyond stage one. You find a few centers now and then that like to do intraperitoneal chemotherapy. It can be effective for palliative benefit, but really it's designed primarily for palliation of symptoms. Hormonal therapy, this limited role, but for all the most futile of cases, response rates, unfortunately, are on the order of 5 to 10%. Most of these patients would have fairly significant toxicity. I typically don't recommend it, but there are occasions it does have its advocates. Radiation therapy may also be of limited value in palliation as well. So for treatment of stage 1 disease, this would be confined to the ovary itself, total abdominal hysterectomy, and bilateral salpingo-oophorectomy. If you have a younger woman who wants to consider having additional children, you can remove the affected ovary, and if there's no bilaterality, she can go ahead and complete her childbearing, and the rest of the gynecologic organs come out on completion of childbearing. Chemotherapy is only if the peritoneal washings are positive. That would technically be stage 1C. For stages 2 through 4, total abdominal hysterectomy, cytoreductive surgery, omentectomy, adjuvant chemotherapy for 6 cycles is generally recommended in that situation. Again, the challenge we have with this disease is if we can catch it early, we can cure the majority of cases. The problem is that these patients don't present until they have more advanced disease in the majority of cases, where unfortunately, as you can see, our survival drops substantially. Now, one of the things that you need to be aware of, and that is the possibility of a metastatic ovarian tumor. These tend to show up on boards as well. Most frequently, these tumors are going to come from the genital tract, breast, or GI tract. If you do studies in terms of what percentage of these are from another site, 5% of ovarian tumors are metastatic. So they're known, but they're not necessarily all that common. In autopsy studies of women with metastatic breast cancer, interestingly enough, the ovaries are involved about 25% of the time. And it kind of brings in the classic example of the Krukenberg tumor, 30 to 40% of metastatic ovarian tumors. The typical definition of that is signet ring adenocarcinoma arising primarily from the stomach, colon, breast, biliary tract, cervix, or bladder. Most of these patients, unfortunately, will pass of their disease within the year.